Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies. I'm Elena McGrath, your host for today. Here with me is Carmen Solis, Associate Professor of History at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Dr. Solis is the author of Fields of Revolution, Agrarian Reform and Rural State Formation in Bolivia, 1935 to 1964, which is out this year from the University of Pittsburgh Press. Welcome, Carmen.
Elena, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. So how did you come to this project?
Well, it's a bit of a long story. I guess that's true for everyone. But just to give you a little bit of a background of who I am, I did my PhD at NYU. But before that, I grew up in Bolivia. I made my I started my BA in Bolivia, in La Paz City. I studied political science. I did my master's in Andean studies in Bolivia, and then another master in Salamanca in Spain in Latin American studies. So at some point between master's and the PhD, I started working with a group of researchers, of Bolivian researchers. It was a project sponsored by the Coordinadora de la Mujer, which would be like the Institute of Women Affairs or something like that in Bolivia. And they wanted to research how Bolivian society, to make it kind of broadly, was responding to cases of child abuse and sexual harassment, in particularly in the countryside. So it was a kind of very broad project. And as I said, it was several researchers working on this. Some people was looking at how, for example, the schools in the countryside were responding to these things, to cases like this. Other group was looking at the community level, how families and community was responding to cases of child abuse. And in my group, I was working with historian Rosana Barragan at that time, and we were looking at how the judicial system was kind of responding to these cases. So we want to look how the state, the police, the attorneys, if those cases even make it to their offices. And well, it was a long research, but I just want to kind of focus on one event that kind of marked me. And I went to Pucarani, which is a town, a village, almost like 50 minutes from La Paz City. I decided to look the office of the attorney. And when I went there, what I found is kind of an empty office. It was Monday, and they said, yeah, just wait for him. He's coming. So it was Tuesday. On a Wednesday, finally, I saw like a very old Volkswagen arriving to Pucarani town. And what I see is this guy who opens his trunk, and he takes out this folding chair and then a folding table, and he installed the thing. He takes out a Bolivian flag, open a file, and says, "How can I do? What can I do for you?" Right. So that kind of made me think, and particularly for someone who's coming from political science, in which we talk about the state, the government, right? The contrast between that image of that very weak image of what is the Bolivian state, particularly in the countryside, versus probably the academic imagination of what was the state. So when I decided for the PhD to work the 50s, I was particularly interested in that question. How was it possible even to launch this one of the most distributive agrarian reforms in the continent if you have this really weak infrastructure? Or even for in terms of people who are a lot more critical of how was the MNRs capable of subordinating all of these peasants and co-opting if they have very limited weapons to do that. So I think that was kind of the initial question, the way I approached my topic.
That's such a great story, and I love the image of the kind of the folding chair state, right? So that brings me to my next question, which is there's a lot of debate about the MNR and about the revolution of 1952, and your book really wades into that debate. So what have scholars said about the agrarian reform and whether the MNR was a radical organization or a force of repression, or what's that debate look like?
I think you're right in this sense of it's really hard to summarize in 2 or 3 minutes, of course, a literature of almost 60 years at this point. Just to summarize, I will say that there are at least 2 views about the agrarian reform. The first one, of course, is the view of the MNR, sponsored by the MNR, the President Pazistensoro, who signed the decree, et cetera, et cetera, who basically argue it is the party that did the agrarian reform. And the peasants were basically beneficiaries, and they didn't even fight in the revolution, right? They recognized the role of the union, of the mine workers in the mines and workers in the Pampas city, et cetera, et cetera. But they really thought of peasants as really passive actors. So that was, I will say, that initial view sponsored by the MNR was later supported for other academics or other historians in Bolivia, but also abroad. I would say that already in the 60s, but mainly in the 70s and 80s, we have a very different view. A lot of people is a lot more critical of the role of the MNR. But primarily, I want to kind of highlight the work and the view of what in Bolivia is called the Taller de Historia Oral Andina, which is the Andean oral history workshop, which is a group of most of them Aymara activists and scholars who have been rethinking and studying Bolivia and revisiting some of the things that we know about Bolivian history. And what probably one of the most important contributions for me is that they say, hey, the peasants did not start awakening in the 50s. They had a very long history of a struggle that started already with Zárate Vilca in the late 19th century and continue with the fight of the caciques apoderados in the 20s, et cetera, et cetera. Then they had a really critical view of the MNR, and especially I want to highlight the work of Silvia Rivera, the sociologist, really important, and her work, Oppressed by Not But Not Defeated. And basically she argues that the MNR was probably almost a counter-revolutionary force that co-opted the peasants, that subordinate the peasants to their political will. And in fact, the agrarian reform ended up implementing a kind of reform based on medium-sized properties, on small-sized properties, that ended up breaking indigenous communal ties, right? So there was a very, very critical view of the revolution and the agrarian reform. And how I position my work, I will say that I, in fact, agree that we gave too much protagonism to the MNR, but I also think that both views in the end, the let's say the MNR view and the TOA view, in the end, both kind of reinforce the idea that the MNR was the agent and that the peasants were in some cases betray or whatever, but they, like, we don't see the agency of the peasantry. And what I show in my work is that we cannot understand the final outcome of the agrarian reform and the depth of the agrarian reform if we don't understand how this peasant and indigenous forces were operating on the ground. So basically that's kind of a huge summary of what the work is.
Absolutely. So and one of the things that your book, I think, does really well is it doesn't just say the peasants were agents. It shows how. It shows how the state had to negotiate with those communities. Well, so since we're talking about agrarian reform, let's talk a little bit about the importance of land in Bolivian history. And your first chapter is really all about how central land was to politics, to wealth, to the nation in up into the revolution and continuing to this day. So can you talk a little bit about what the regions were that made up your study and what land ownership looked like, what labor looked like prior to 1952?
Sure. So I basically ended up studying three regions, three provinces, and they are very, very different in terms of their geography. I pick up Omasuyos, which is in the highlands, in the Bolivian highlands, Yungas, which is this tropical, subtropical area, also in La Paz, and then one region, Germán Jordán, in the valleys of Cochabamba. And the three of them, as I said, geographically are really different, but they have in common that the three of them had the hacienda system was really strong in these three places. The other crucial difference in this place is that in these three places is that the history of the hacienda was a little bit different. In the case of Cochabamba, the formation of the hacienda already started in the colonial period. As you know, the valleys of Cochabamba are so close to Potosí that since very early on, these regions were providing wheat and corn to the mines of Potosí. So Spanish landlords were really interested in taking this place. Then in the case of Yungas has been the traditional area for the production of coca, also the production that was going to the mines. So again, landlords were really interested also in grabbing lands in this area. So you have the formation of the hacienda also in particularly claim, talking about the 18th century. And then in the La Paz and on the highlands are a little bit of the contrast, because indigenous communities managed to survive and to control lands for much of the colonial period in this area, but really they suffer expropriation and land grabbing as the product of liberalism, right? That primarily happened in the 19th century. So the kind of the history is a bit different in these cases. In all of these cases, what you find is peasants, what in Bolivia we call colonos, which of course they had the chance or the opportunity to have a plot of land within the hacienda for the survival of their families. And in exchange, there were no wages. They have to work for the landlord, which is, of course, the system that you also find in Peru, you find in Chile at that time. Probably one of the things that we want to highlight is the amount of services that these colonos ended up doing for a landlord. That's the other thing that I think sometimes we forget. It was not only that they were harvesting or cropping things for the landowner, but everything else was in the shoulders or rely in the shoulders of these workers. And for example, they had to carry all the production from the countryside to the cities, and the animals were provided by the colonos. The rope to tie the harvest was provided by the colonos. There were cases, for example, that I found of haciendas that they bought tractors kind of to improve the mechanization of the hacienda. And colonos complained that the gas was paid by the colonos. Right? So it's unbelievable the amount of exploitation. They have to work, of course, as peons in the household of the landlord, and the wives have to also develop this chores. They have to wave, they produce chicha, etc., etc., etc. So I think when we think almost, when sometimes I start reading about this, it was like, well, harvesting doesn't sound that bad. It's like, no, well, that's 1% of the other 99% of things that they have to develop in that environment. The other thing that I would like to highlight, and that was another kind of key argument for me in the first chapter, was that what I see already since the late 1930s was that the landlords were really interested, not only the landlords, but the right in Bolivia was really interested in developing what they call a program of agrarian reform. But it was a conservative program of agrarian reform. And that started already in the 40s, particularly with the president of Peñaranda. And he created the agricultural bank. He granted credits to landlords. They created the Bolivian Rural Society almost at that time, also because they want to kind of have landlords participating in the board of the agricultural bank. And what I saw, there were like a number of credits given to landlords in La Paz and Cochabamba. So they were actively thinking of an agrarian reform, and we in Bolivia, we could have perfectly have a different path, right? A path in which, like in the 40s, they were thinking that the landlords were going to be the agents of change and progress in Bolivia, right? And I think we kind of forgot that. And nowadays, particularly in Bolivia, we kind of understand that agrarian reform is a synonym of land distribution, but that was not always the case.
I found that really fascinating that Bolivia, like many other places, had this drive towards agrarian industrialization or modernization and all of these things. But it was land reform as undertaken by landlords, right? And that and so I think your second chapter really kind of builds on this idea that land reform wasn't invented as an idea by the MNR in 1952, 1953, right? So there were contests over what land reform meant and what problem it was seeking to solve before that. And so one example is this landlord-led Peñaranda modernization in the 40s. But can you talk a little bit about some of the debates that were happening also on the left about what land reform could do? What would it fix? What problem would it solve?
Yes, and thank you for that question. I think what the goal of that chapter two, was primarily to show that land reform in the end was basically a container, and a container of a lot of ideas, right? And what for me was interesting to see in all those pamphlets published in the 40s, I like the titles were super revolutionary. And then when I look at the content, I was like, this is not going very far, at least looking probably from the eyes of someone who already went through or already saw the revolution happening. And what I find, for example, in the text of the MNR, they were thinking primarily, and I think the best example of that is the signature of the street decrees by Villarroel in 1945, in which they're thinking in reform primarily in terms of improving the life of on the working conditions for colonos. They are not thinking about expropriation or changing property relations in the countryside. So they were like, well, maybe they can we can put some rules that make exploitation slightly less oppressive. That was it. So they were thinking more in labor rather than in property. But also I find really interesting how the left party was really critical of the MNR and the Indigenous Congress led by Villarroel. And they said, well, this is not enough. And I was kind of waiting for that text that was going to reveal what was the plan. And they were talking about, we need modernization and we need machines and seeds and et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, okay, so they are not talking about, they were very shy about even kind of referring to expropriation. But also I think they were shy and, as I said, careful because they were facing the powerful Bolivian Rural Society. And in fact, what I see in that chapter is the answer. But the left party basically suggests, why don't we create an Institute of Agrarian Reform that will kind of study the case in Bolivia, what's happening in Bolivia. And the Eduardo del Granado, who was the representative of the Cochabamba Rural Society, answers, and he says, these communists are trying to destroy the country, et cetera, et cetera. So I think for me, on the one hand, I wanted to show kind of the ambiguity of the suggestions about and how careful and how much they were trying to even imagine. And I think there were a couple of texts that I collected from people who was writing already in the 40s, but also in the early 50s, right after the revolution, in which they were saying like, well, maybe the colonos can pay back the landlords, right? So things, they were very careful. But as I said, we cannot understand that if we don't understand the weight also of the Bolivian rural society in the 40s.
Yeah, and the sort of unthinkability of actual transformation of property relations becomes very visible. It's like before, just a few years even before there is this land reform that takes on a form that is, you know, taking land away and giving it to other people, you have just a bunch of people saying, okay, well, maybe there shouldn't be free labor.
Yeah.
We'll see what we can do, right?
Yeah,
and so,
yeah.
So your next chapter is about the early years of the MNR revolution. So in 1952, you have this party taking power. And in retrospect, the land reform of 1953 was one of the big pillars of their revolution. But what you argue and you show is that in the early days, they wanted to reform rural labor relations. They wanted to have wages. They wanted to make working conditions better, but not redistribution. But you show how in their efforts to sort of assert their own political power and take, you know, insert the state into the countryside, they had to change that plan. And so can you talk a little bit about that chapter?
Yeah. And I think you phrase it really beautifully, Elena. Like, I think you phrase the chapter even better than I was ever able to do it. I love it. Thank you so much for that. I think you're totally right. On the one hand, I quote several statements from, for example, the head of the Department of Agriculture in 1952, Germán Vera Tapia. I'm sorry, in 1953 already, he argues, we're not going to touch anyone's property, right? Already in the context of the revolution, they are saying things like that. And in some cases, the left and the MNR, when they were talking about, we need to give land to the Indian, and they added, in the lowlands. Right, in those areas of colonization. So they were, again, really
the
afraid.
Empty
of.
Lands we can the give.
Empty lands, exactly. Exactly. So they had a lot of trouble just thinking how on earth we're going to deal with these landlords. And at the same time, what I see is that I will say that the MNR, primarily because of its own survival, and I'm thinking in Paz Estenssoro, and literally when I'm saying his own survival, I'm talking really in literal terms. He was really afraid to end up like Villarroel hang in the plaza. So he really understood, because of the experience of Villarroel, and they were so close to that government, that that just seizing power was not enough, that they really needed to undermine the networks of power also in the countryside. So one of the things that they started doing was to attack really directly the Bolivian rural society, the Yunga society, the Cochabamba society. They were, most of their members were really early on in jail because they were accused of being falangistas and conservative. Undermining the role of the MNR. So many of them migrated to Peru, for example, as exiles. And at the same time, what I see is that at the local level, and here I needed a little bit of parentheses, what you find prior to the revolution were this, what they call the rural councils. This is before the revolution. And it was conformed, this is informal associations, conformed primarily by landowners or kind of the most important merchants or priests, or, you know, the kind of the important, quote unquote, people in that little town. And what they do every year was to send tree names to the governor of the Department of La Paz, what in La Paz is known as the prefecto. And they will basically say, okay, here are the kind of the names that we suggest for you to be the next corregidor, intendente, the next subprefect of our province. Thank you so much. So this was this informal mechanism in which they will basically control, of course they put their own people, they control local power. And what I see and I find fascinating was that the MNR eliminated those rural councils and decided that it was going to be the peasant unions that were going to take that role. And I think that we kind of we haven't paid enough attention to that process. But what I argue in the book is that it was a very profound form of democratization of the state that really allowed peasant unions to control that their regions. And you and I think I read this in other works and previous works in which, well, it's not a big thing. At the end, you know, they didn't have enough money, which is true. But that mechanism systematically undermine and sabotage the all power of these local elites. So I think it was a really important process. And already when those relations of power were changed, it was really hard for the MNR not to have an agrarian reform that was not distributing property. So I think both processes went together.
Yeah, that I really liked the way you talked about the kind of democratization of the actual mechanisms of power that the state relied upon to enact things. And so one of the key parts of your argument is these peasant unions, which some people have suggested were sort of created by the MNR, but you're showing these are unions that peasants have been trying to unionize at least since the 1930s and organizing in other ways long before that. And so what you show is that there's an explosion of unions in this period. And what you suggest is that partly builds on this expertise of organization that was clearly already there on the ground.
Absolutely. And I think just to add to what you said, I think one of the things that we forgot in our revision of the history is that Bush and Toro in the 30s, late 30s, opened the possibility for workers to organize unions. And then you don't see that many unions in the country, the peasant unions. You see a lot of mine workers unions, but or urban unions, but not that many peasant unions. But I think what we forgot is that in Peñaranda in the early 40s, with a new decree, banned peasant unions from getting organized. So what I think what was happening was that there was a huge demand to unionize. And what the MNR did with the decree in 1952 was unblock something that there that was already part of a demand from grassroots demand.
I really like the way when you were talking about Estensoros, like fear, visceral fear of being hung from a lamppost, right? I think that the 1952 revolution has so much more to do with the 40s than we think about. And what happened in the 40s was a kind of suppression of rural and urban dissent that was already going on. There's this pent up demand of people are getting more active, but they were being prevented. So I want to talk about this concept that you talk about, which is this everyday forms of revolution, as you're building off of Scott and kind of everyday forms of state formation. And so in your fourth chapter, I'm bringing this question in here because I think your fourth chapter is really interesting because you allow for these kind of technical debates at the national level and even the international level. You show how Guatemalan experts and Mexican experts were coming in to say, this is land reform. This is what we can do. But that on the ground, it's the peasant unions who are saying, we want this. And you find that the government is often just ratifying the de facto agreements, regardless of what the law says. So how does everyday forms of revolution work in the Bolivian land reform?
Yeah, thank you. I think that probably the idea in part also was to almost rethink this idea that the revolution is that thing with capital R, and think in this revolutionary processes in this more granular way that I wanted to see from the very beginning of the beginnings of my research. And what I find is, and one of the things that I'm trying to show, not only in that chapter, but also in the other chapters, was that, you know, just the decision of the union to not grant or not give the harvest of that year to the landlord, the decision of eating the very expensive cattle of the landlord in a barbecue, right? Or the decision of organizing a union, the role of the head of the rural society, or not the rural society, the rural council in Omasuyos to almost distribute lands, although he did not have the attribute to do that, or to even like forget to call the landlord to attend the audiencia, or those what it seems really minimum or activities that are not revolutionary activities where this capital are, but they were what I think is fundamental for sabotaging and undermining systematically the all power of the elites. And all those everyday acts of resistance in that or acts of revolution is what basically I'm trying to show.
In your introduction, you sort of bring up these granular forms of rebellion, like eating the cattle so that they're gone, right? And turning that into a party. That one of the things you suggest is that this is something that maybe peasants do all the time, but is not enough, right? Is not necessarily enough. So what happened in the Bolivian Revolution, it seems like, is that a state that was trying to change things from above met with this profound this profound level of chaos on some level from below, and decided that in some cases it needed to ratify those decisions.
Yeah, well, I think there were a number of things happening. I think if you look at the 50s also, the MNR is dealing with a lot of enemies at the same time. So I was also intrigued and amazed by how on earth you deal with so many things. On the one hand, they have the very combatant, strong unions in the mines, which are really potent. They are basically in the government. You have the U.S., which is a massive headache, to say the least, for the MNR. You need to negotiate the price of the tin. But also, as if that wouldn't be enough, but just touching some properties, they were touching the church, the Catholic Church. And I have a lot of fun just collecting this, the exchange of letters between the Archbishop and Walter Guevara Arce, in which the Archbishop is crazy. And Walter Guevara Arce says, like, well, we're following the principles of, what's the name of the priest of the 16th century, the Bartolome. So we were very Catholic. That's what we're doing.
We are the original priests, right?
Yeah. And so in that context, and the other thing that I found was that internal reports from the MNR said, like, we barely control 10% of the unions, right? So the capacity of controlling the unions was really, really limited. So in that context, I think it worked much better for the MNR to let these unions continue with the process of expropriation, of consolidating the land. They never did something that, for example, I found in other cases in Latin America, in Mexico, or even worse, in the case of Cuba, in which they have state farms and they're regulating who's going to produce what. The Bolivian state or the MNR didn't dare to get there. It's like, whatever you think is fine. Basically, they were signing the titles, right? But it was the unions who led that process.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that is what is so interesting, is that, in Mexico, you have these big collective projects, and the Bolivian state is like, maybe we could do that in the future. And so that actually gets us to rethink the chronology of the revolution, because we're talking about the MNR right now, which was found itself really besieged on all sides, unable to control the peasant union. So they start signing papers and they say, this is going to be better for us. But what you show is that once the MNR fell and you have a series of military dictatorships, they also felt like they needed to negotiate with the peasants, right? The Barrientos, Banzer, you have the agrarian reform is not rolled back when the revolutionary government falls to military regimes. And so you actually talk about the process of peasant consolidation of the countryside continuing into the 80s. And so this kind of changes the way that revolution and reaction is thought about in the Bolivian case.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think especially what is in terms of what happened in terms of land reform and agrarian reform, I think it's really different from the political timing when we think nationalization of the mines and what is happening in that realm, or what is happening with the oil, which at this moment was already reprivatized by the MNR. So I think one of the things that I was trying to argue is that we need to think in the timing of the revolution, or in terms of the agrarian reform, or what is happening in the countryside, in kind of rethinking. It's not parallel of what is happening in other areas. And what I show is that I found really interesting that in 1964, when Barrientos comes to power, which is this military regime that overthrows 12 years of the MNR being in power, immediately I found the letters of landlords sending in letters to Barrientos and saying, like, this has been horrible and chaotic, and we really need a kind of a regime like this to revise the expropriation, not only of uncultivated properties, but this government, the 12 years under the MNR, they distribute cultivated properties, medium-sized properties, properties in which there was investment, and the agrarian reform was not about that, which is true. I find a lot of cases in which there were medium-sized properties, there were properties in which you find investment, and they ended up in expropriating those properties. But what for me is really interesting, and I think that is what distinguished the Bolivian case versus, for example, the case of Chile, the case of Peru, the case of Guatemala, the military or the kind of conservative regimes that took power in the cases of Peru, Chile, and Guatemala immediately undid the conquest of the agrarian, the distribution, and the gainings that peasants won in the revolutionary context. And what I say is that the Barrientos and later Banzer, which is even more conservative, did not dare to touch the gainings of the agrarian reform. There were reasons for that. There are a couple of important reasons. One of them was that they were looking at the lowlands at this point. They thought it was probably politically too expensive for them to even dare to touch the lands in the valleys and in the highlands. It is also true that they also were more worried about the mine workers more than the peasants, and they needed almost the ally. And the peasants, they signed what was called in Bolivia the Military Peasant Pact. However, I think previous scholars, rightly so, have pointed out how this pact was beneficial for the military. But I think we also need to think how this pact was beneficial for the peasants, right? Because it was this moment, it was in the 60s and 70s and 80s, when I see that some landowners who were able to keep a piece of land after the agrarian reform, they expropriated, they lost most of their land, but they were able to keep a medium-sized property. In the 60s, in the 70s, knowing that they didn't have the support of the government, they end up or just leaving the property, selling the property. And it's in this month, this decades, in the 70s and 80s, that Aymara and Quechua peasants are going to kind of become the control these areas. And that is the case up to today, which is probably one of the huge difference between Bolivia and other countries in Latin America.
It's a profound difference when you think about the rural agrarian societies of the 40s. And then today, you don't have this landlord power. It's not there. I think that's a really, really important way to think about it. And so let's now talk about how the land reform and we've been talking about peasants, and we've been talking mostly about colonos, right? But now let's talk a little bit about the differences between the situation of the comuneros and the colonos. And I really like the way that you bring in this idea of how giving land back to the original owners is quite a different proposition to giving land back to those who work it, or giving land to those who work it.
Yeah, I think I work on that on chapter five, I think. Is it chapter five? And what I basically wanted to show, and this is not new, of course. It is the work of a lot of researchers that have been working in the years of before the revolution in early 1910s and 1920s, the work of Silvia Rivera, the work of Laura Gutkowitz, and they showed the relevance of these movements of if people who lost land to landlords, who in Bolivia are called the comunarios, and they call themselves ex-comunarios, and their leaders, which in Bolivia were called at that in the 1920s, the caciques apoderados. And they were forcefully trying to demand, sometimes through rebellions or revolts, and sometimes through legal movements, they were claiming for the restitution of the lands, particularly the ones they lost in the 19th century with liberalism. But also these researchers, what they were arguing is that this movement, the Cacique Apoderado movement, kind of waned down after the Chaco War, that, you know, all of a sudden kind of we changed gears, we're a lot more interested in the 40s in colonos' rights, and kind of the comunario movement, the Cacique Apoderado movement, died. And so it was very surprising for me to find in the archives to find letters of caciques apoderados writing to President Paces de Nzoro in 1952 and 1953 and arguing this, that we are with you, we are the revolution. But that thing of land for those who work it, we really disagree with that point. We actually want land for their original owners, right? We don't want expropriation. We want restitution of our lands. And what I find amazing, and I don't think, I think my work is contributing with that, we didn't pay attention to the decree that Paces de Nzoro signed in 1954, recognizing the right of indigenous communities to restitution. And then when I moved to the province of Omasuyos and I started looking at the agrarian files, I find a lot of demands for land restitution. And I see how successful were the comunario demands. And also one of the things that I show in that chapter, but I think we need a lot more research in other provinces of the highlands to see if it was kind of is it only Omasuyos or what was happening in other highland provinces? But there was also the promise of restitution brought tensions between the colonos and the comunarios, because of course the landlords brought other people, landless peasants, to work with them as colonos, and they were not interested in moving away and giving back the land to the comunarios. So that created also a lot of tensions.
And I think that's something that kind of gets flattened when we think about agrarian reform, but it's something that comes up in Mexico too. It's something that comes up in Guatemala as well. When you're talking about the land reform, there are indigenous communities who say, these are our titles, these are our colonial titles. And then you have the people who are like, we are working the land and we are owed the land. And the case of Bolivia is so interesting because you have that decree from 1954 that does offer land restitution. And so the conflict, there is an inherent conflict there in redistributing land in terms of who gets it. But there is this sort of basis for originarios to get their land in certain ways. And it's interesting. I wonder if does that conflict play out in sort of destabilizing local power relationships during the 50s?
Yes, and I also think that, and probably this is also a way in which I'm trying to kind of revisit some of the previous historiography. I think the way in which we saw the relation between the project of the state or the project of the MNR versus the project from the bottom, you know, the kind of Toa and Silvia Rivera and other scholars have been looking at, you have kind of the unionization project was coming from above, the claim of land for those who work it was coming from above, and then you have demands from below that were kind of more oriented, that there were the indigenous people or comunarios demanding for communal property. And what I think what was happening is that both political projects are coming from below. The colonos are really interested in defending the view of the MNR of land for those who work it. And they use the union, they find in the union a very useful weapon, not only to fight the landlords, but also to fight against the comunarios, right? And so I it's a lot more complicated. And what I think, and I'm thinking in the work of anthropologist Amy Kennemore, but also other people that have been looking at conflicts between what today we call comunidad versus sindicato, union versus community. And I think these conflicts were latent conflicts that precisely started in the 50s that anthropologists are looking at those conflicts today. So those tensions just by the borders of or the control that the ex hacienda versus the land that was going to be controlled by the community continue to be there. I don't think they are solved.
I think my final question for you is just what now? I mean, it's a great book. It's a book that covers so much ground in terms of our understanding of the revolution and the countryside. What are you working on now?
That's a great question. That's an existential question.
Yes, right? I imagine.
Well, one of the things that I really would like to explore, and I think we did a lot, I'm thinking in classes too, when you teach Latin American history in the 20th century, you look at what were the effects of the Cuban Revolution, but we don't know much about what were the effects of the Bolivian Revolution. And particularly, I want to focus on the effects of the agrarian reform, which came 6 years prior to the Cuban Revolution. What was the reaction of other countries? And I'm really intrigued primarily by the reaction of the Peruvian government, who they were really concerned about the spread of the revolution on their country. So they didn't have another better idea than to close the frontiers. So that they were so worried about that. So I really want to explore. I don't have all the material, but kind of working in that direction. And then I'm also interested in the decline of the MNR, let's say, and I want to study the hyperinflation. I'm kind of beginning the project, but I want to move to the 80s. I'm not sure where I'm going yet, but I have threats of or where I want to go.
Well, that sounds fascinating. I can't wait. Well, thank you so much for your time, Carmen, and I look forward to talking to you in the future when some of those other projects are out.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure. Thank you.